Welcome to the Tennessee on Supply Chain Management podcast. Listen in as co-hosts Ted Stank and Tom Goldsby take a leap onto the ships of supply chain, crowd surf into the long lines of meeting holiday demand, and wade into the depths of warehouse inventory buildup. They'll cover all the relevant and current topics blocking the canal of your minds and discuss industry issues that keep you up at night. If you enjoy the show, download and subscribe to Tennessee on Supply Chain Management, wherever you listen to podcasts. Without further ado, let's begin our show, where you'll hear what you'd least expect from the people you want to hear it from the most. Our co-hosts, Ted and Tom.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Tennessee on Supply Chain Management. It's the podcast brought to you from Rocky Top, University of Tennessee, Knoxville. I'm your co-host, Tom Goldsby, joined by my good friend, colleague, co-host, Ted Stank. Dr. Ted Stank, how are you today?
Hey, man. I'm doing well, Thomas. How are you? We just finished all the craziness of graduation a week ago, so we're all kind of settling into summer schedules and working on all the many projects we've got going on.
That's exactly right. I'm recording in the office today, and I'm just looking out my window, and there's not a soul to be seen walking around, not even any of those wheeled robots going around campus. They kind of lie dormant when the students are gone for the most part. But hey, things were rocking during our last podcast here at Rocky Top, weren't they? We recorded at the Supply Chain Forum, downtown Knoxville, and we had more than 300 of our corporate friends present, and more than that, in fact, more than 300 students, faculty, staff members, more than 600 attendees in total. Just an incredible scene. And Ted, I know that you are instrumental in that, got us kicked off with a Chief Supply Chain Officer panel. Tell us a little bit about some of the highlights from that session.
Well, I mean, we talked a lot about agility. I mean, obviously, that's on the tip of everyone's tongue. And for chief supply chain officers of giant companies like Hewlett-Packard and Colgate-Palmolive, the name of the game today is how do they become more agile? Talked a lot about digital and technology issues and how they're pulling that increasingly into the kind of things they're doing so that they can get a leg up on seeing the future and preparing for it. Talked a lot about how the outside world in which we exist is changing. And so they're realigning supply chains, things like allied shoring, particularly Hewlett-Packard with the electronics industry and how they're trying to realign not just semiconductors, but a lot of subcomponent parts to be able to get those products in-house better, more efficiently, and quicker than what we experienced over the last few years. So, you know, a lot of things like that. They also talked about talent. You never talk to chief supply chain officers without them saying they spend a lot of time thinking about talent, the availability of talent, the ability to retain talent, the ability to upskill people to be able to compete in the new world that we increasingly confront. So it was a great way to kick us off.
It really was. And I know you all also talked about supply chain planning, which I followed up. I was really pleased to host a couple of supply chain VPs and Craig Ellenin of Bush Brothers, as well as Clay Jackson of Tractor Supply. And we talked about how supply chain planning needs to evolve, maybe revolve. It needs to change dramatically to accommodate the dynamic supply demand environments in which we find ourselves. But that was just the kickoff. Also, as mentioned at the podcast, we had a chance to interview a company that just got recognized as the number one supply chain company on the planet, Schneider Electric. And that was a really great conversation. I encourage everyone, if you didn't hear that previous podcast, we had three people from the supply chain HR world come and talk about just what Ted was indicating, attracting, retaining, developing that talent. It was really fantastic. But Schneider Electric was recognized number one, but we had a lot of friends get recognized in the top 25 by Gartner.
Yeah, you know, I'm starting off with two of our top partners, Apple and Procter & Gamble, are considered by Gartner's supply chain masters because they always came out in the top five. And so over time, Gartner said, you know what, we're going to make these companies master companies. What do we have, Tom? Five of the top six companies, including Schneider Electric. You want to go down through the list just to recognize those partners of ours?
Absolutely. So we had Schneider Electric at number one, Colgate-Palmolive came in at number three, Johnson & Johnson number four, PepsiCo at number five, Pfizer at number six. So that's five of the top six. We jumped to Walmart at number nine and Coca-Cola at number 11, Dell at number 19. And certainly as you look at the balance of that top 25, at one time or another, I think we've touched base or had recruiters from those companies make their their way to Rocky Top. So it's just tremendous to have that kind of connection. As you point out, you know, the masters that are no longer considered in the rankings because they just routinely were top five, with Amazon and P&G in particular also being good friends of ours.
Yeah, the comment I'll make, and this is a little foreshadowing of the topic we're going to hit on with our special guests later, but a number of those companies also participate with us in collaborative research, and it's a really value-adding relationship for both sides, for those companies as well as for us as a top program supply chain, to work together to continue to find new ways to improve performance in supply chain. And I think that's an interesting topic for us to dig into later on, is what is the role that academia and academic research plays in the performance of these companies.
Well, that's a good foreshadow of our podcast, but let's get to some broader economic foreshadowing. It's one of those things that, you know, while we're recording this right after Memorial Day, it seems like the negotiations between the executive branch and Congress is kind of achieved some accomplishment. Seems like the major points anyway, there are going to certainly be some finer points resolved in the Congress and Senate. But this debt ceiling negotiation that has been lurking,
you know, I just think it's high drama. It's performance art. Tom, you've spent a little time in the halls of Congress, and I remember you telling me that when you met with these people in their offices, they were totally different from the personalities that came out of their offices in the hallway.
Caricatures of themselves.
Yeah, they have to play a particular character. And this, to me, is their like Broadway moment when they do the debt ceiling. You know, it's like, they're all posturing. I wish the media wouldn't pay so darn much attention to it. You know, last week it was like, oh, Kevin McCarthy just rolled his eyes. That must mean we don't have a debt ceiling agreement. And then the market responds. And then, oh, Joe Biden came out smiling. That must mean we have a debt ceiling agreement. And the market responds. It's like, come on, guys, this is just ridiculous. It's performance art. We're the only democracy in the world that has this debt ceiling limit thing that we've got to deal with. And I think it's for both sides to just kind of make their political points and try to get some negotiation leeway for the kind of things they're just trying to push.
But man, it could be so costly.
They're not going to do that. They're not going to do it, because it would be catastrophic to whichever party is positioned as the one. I also enjoy, I mean, for most people that know me, I'm kind of a political centrist, and the far left and the far right are both screaming about it. Someone once told me that the mark of a great negotiation is when neither side comes away from the table happy. And I think that's kind of what we've got here. And we just need to continue to get on with business. Tom, as an individual investor, you should not do that. Lots of people have lost a lot of their money trying to time when the market goes down and then when it comes back up. So you need to close your eyes. You've got a long time left in your work career, and let the professionals decide.
But hey, let's bring it back to the supply chain world. Certainly been a lot of action going on. UPS, we're getting closer and closer to a deadline on the need for a deal, I should say, the expiration of the previous agreement between the Teamsters and UPS. And I'm kind of hearing that things are coming together, that maybe we won't see a strike out of the Teamsters. But that would be, use the word catastrophic. I think it'd be catastrophic for the business if they were to go down that path.
Yeah, you know, labor negotiations are touchy things. There's always potential in the background for the federal government to step in for key industries. I mean, that happened with the rail industry back in the late fall. Looks like West Coast labor is working itself out pretty well, that we're not going to have that threat. But, you know, in terms of UPS, is that a key industry, a key company for our economy? A lot of people would argue yes. And so I think that's always in the background of these negotiators, that if they don't get a deal done, the federal government's going to come in and mandate something. So I think they'll get something done.
It'd be interesting for those competitors to UPS. I think they've been preparing for possibly picking up a lot of new business should there be a strike, even, you know, recognizing that the Teamsters don't represent the whole of the labor environment at UPS, but they're certainly the lion's share of it. And it was way back in 97, you and I had a different zip code. We were living in East Lansing, Michigan back when UPS went on strike in 97, and certainly FedEx, Postal Service. Today, we have these regional carriers that I think would step up in a big way and see a lot of opportunity. But there is this freight recession going on. You know, more and more indications it's suggesting that we are kind of falling behind year over year numbers, even from the pre-pandemic period. And I know there was some expectation that imports were maybe going to see a little bit of a boost coming into the summer season. But so far, it doesn't seem like whether it's on the ocean or in the air, we're seeing that boost. Maybe it's taking a little bit longer for that inventory to burn down, but people are spending money, right? They're just traveling, right? It was a record-setting Memorial Day weekend. People are just choosing to spend their money on stuff other than stuff right now.
Maybe it's because I'm old, Tom, and I've seen different trends. I just find it so interesting that we get so focused on what is the trend line of the last recent period. And then if today doesn't equal what the last recent period was, we run around saying the sky is falling. Well, of course, we're not importing or exporting as much freight as we did in 2022, because in 2022, we were recovering from one of the greatest global economic crises that we've had in 100 years. So yeah, we're going to move a lot of freight during 2022. So then we stocked up, and you and I wrote the Wall Street Journal article about the bullwhip effect, right? Then we stocked up and we had all kinds of extra stock. And over time, that stock is actually kind of easing and we're starting to get to a more normalized inventory level. So the sky's not falling. We just have cycles and we're in a certain cycle right now. Consumers are still spending. April's consumer numbers were up from March, highest number since January. And January was a pretty high mark. Everybody was surprised by that. I wish from an overall economic standpoint, we had more decisive data to talk about. For the last many months, we've been a broken record. Some of the economic data is positive. Some of it isn't so positive. I think everybody thinks that we're going to have what we might call a recession in the next quarter or so, but might look more really just like a slower business cycle as the world catches its breath from where we've been the last few years. The caveat you always have to put in is barring another economic shock, right? Because we thought we'd come out of this quicker and then the Russia-Ukraine war started. Who knows what else is around the corner? But if there's nothing other major issue around the corner, I think that we'll go through a bit of a slowdown, standard business cycle, and we'll be positioned to come out of it relatively stronger as we move forward.
Yeah, I've been throwing around that VUCA acronym quite a bit of late, speaking of environments that are highly volatile, uncertain, complex, and loaded with ambiguity. And the business leaders with which I throw that around, they seem to nod in agreement to that. Hey, one data point that I do want to bring up that is consistent with some realignment may be happening in our supply chains. And you brought this to my attention as a Wall Street Journal article a few weeks back about the incredible volumes of freight coming through the port of Laredo. So Mexico to U.S. imports that now have rivaled and I believe outpaced the volume of cargo coming in from our West Coast L.A. Long Beach ports, which traditionally we've thought of those as each representing about 20% of import volume on the ocean, so about 40% in total. And meanwhile, this article pointed out that on the ground, imports from Mexico are now outpacing those coming in to LA and Long Beach from Asia.
I remember back in the post-NAFTA days in the 90s, when there was all kinds of prediction. I remember doing a presentation at what was then CLM, now CSCMP, talking about lots of shifts in freight flows that used to go east-west in the United States because imports and exports would come in through the coasts and increasingly was going to come up through Mexico. Maybe that stuff was before its time. But I think, again, now as we think about the realignments that's going on globally and the investment in manufacturing and distribution in Mexico, I think we're going to continue to see that kind of trend, that more freight's coming from our ally, if you will, in Mexico and where we have manufacturing for distribution in the United States. I'm going to brag a little bit, Tom. 2014 Epic Book, right? It said the big thing is we're going to go to regional supply and demand pods, and we're seeing that today.
Only took a decade for it to happen.
It only took 3 decades from the 90s and NAFTA, right? So, you know, we've touched on this topic several times already today, the importance of planning. That's a good segue for us to talk to our two guests today. These are colleagues of ours who have been doing really incredible research, teaching, and oftentimes when we work with practitioners, we'll get into the conversation. What is the role of business academia, supply chain academia to business practice? And we thought we'd spend some time talking to two of our stars on our faculty and to get their notion, the kind of things they're working on and how they see their role rolling forward in that.
Yeah, sure. First up is Dr. Stephanie Eckerd. And Stephanie is a two-time winner, and she's been on the faculty here at UT twice with a little stint at Indiana University in between. But we are so thrilled that Stephanie came back to UT Haslam. She serves as the Ratledge Professor of Supply Chain Management. A little birdie told me that she's going to be named to a kind of a higher order professorship, maybe a little bit later this summer, the FedEx professor. So congratulations in advance to Stephanie for that. So we're pleased to have Stephanie and also Dr., and I emphasize the doctor, Annie Doman. Annie is that doctoral student that Ted spoke of in the past tense. She is now a full-fledged faculty member. She's about to join the Broad College of Business at Michigan State University, a place that Ted and I know quite well. And we're so thrilled. She did great work in the 4 years she was here at UT, and we know she's going to do great things at Michigan State. So welcome, Stephanie and Annie.
Great. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. I've been wanting to be on this podcast for a while, so it's nice to see what goes on behind the scenes.
And I'm sure you're just overwhelmed by what you're experiencing. It's pretty clear.
Well, Tom and Stephanie and I know Annie really well, and overwhelmed is not usually a descriptor that comes up for Annie. Let's jump into this. You know, I mean, I think all of us on this podcast, Tom and I, Stephanie, Annie, all have had work experience in the business world. We all worked out in business for a while before we changed course dramatically and went into academia. I think all of us did 4 years as very poor, starving doctoral students before we went out and started making money again. What drives somebody to make that decision after you've been, you know, on a successful course in a career? Stephanie, what drove you to kind of want to be a professor of business and supply chain?
Oh, I have to give credit back in my MBA program. I left the working world to get a full-time MBA. And while I was there, I had the privilege of doing some research work with one professor, Barbara Flynn, and she was really instrumental in me making that decision to transition to the academic world. And I haven't looked back. It's a lot of fun. If I ever think about returning to industry, it takes about 10 seconds to flip and realize I got a pretty good gig going with this teaching, research, academic lifestyle.
So. Yeah, well, with all that chaos we were talking about at the outset of the program, it's like, hey, being able to study it and observe and talk about it as opposed to being in the throes of it certainly has its merits. One thing I failed to point out in Stephanie's introduction is that she also serves as our director of the PhD program. So I think that's probably going to come into play in our later conversation as well. But Annie, tell us about your journey from academics to industry and back to academics.
So when I was an undergrad, I always thought that I would go back into academia, but I knew speaking to other professors that it's a good idea to get some industry experience. So after 5 years of working, I had a really great opportunity to go and get my master's at Iowa State in engineering. Though I started engineering, I continued my master's in engineering. And while I was doing my master's, I got pulled into a supply chain project. It was just really cool. I liked the fact that it was a problem that was more on a broad perspective, looking at things from a bird's eye view and trying to figure out how are these issues not only for this one company that we're working with, but can be applied to a lot of different companies. And at that point, I just fell in love with supply chain problems and supply chain research and decided to join Tennessee 4 years ago. And it's been great so far.
So far, and again, it's kind of a new beginning for you as you are about a month away from packing your bags and heading up to East Lansing. And like I said, doing great things. You know, something I hope it comes through time and time again in the podcast, our blending of theory and practice. And it's something that we very much take to heart. And we try to fulfill what Chad Autry, our associate dean for faculty and research, calls the virtuous cycle. We conduct research that is based upon industry challenges. We conduct that research with the aid of industry. And then we take the responsibility of closing that loop and reporting back to industry. And Annie, I think that your dissertation is a great example of that. Can we kind of get a quick upshot? I know that she completed 3 distinct essays. All of us were on her committee, so we know it intimately. But generally, what was the question that drove your research, and what were a few of the key findings from that work?
Yeah, so I started in 2019. And at that point, I thought I was going to be doing research in agriculture, research in agility. I had quite a few different topics that were brought up. And I got pulled into a project actually by Ted in the second week of me being here. that looked at agility in different contexts. And of course, in 2020, we had a perfect field experiment for understanding how agility can be applied in different ways. We got into a project, which was my first dissertation essay, that looked at what happened after COVID-19 and the different responses that companies had. We had one company in particular that we worked with that they did a bunch of different changes. So we built a simulation model for them that was able to pick apart those different changes that they made to see what are the changes that made the most difference for them to come back to normal business practices. At that point, it was really supply chain planning, and that's what got me really interested in supply chain planning and how firms can leverage that. So it started with that first project, and it expanded into another company that makes customization and customized products. So understanding how planning impacts their ability to meet customer service levels. And then finally, I'm also working on a behavioral paper that looks at planner reactions after a disruption. How do people respond whenever their volatility increases quite a bit, such as what happened in COVID-19? That's where that project originally started. It has then since expanded, and it's been great. So all three of my essays worked with different industry partners around UT and through GSCI. And I think it's kind of a unique dissertation because it is very intimate with different companies. And we did have to do the let's figure out what the problem is, let's meet, let's figure out the solution, and then also loop back and get some other qualitative data and really understand what's going on in these companies and how can that be applied to the broader business set.
Well, from what I gather, and Ted was co-chair of your dissertation, so maybe I should give him an opportunity to weigh in on this, but you really fulfilled that vision that we have for, again, conducting research that is informed with industry, and then in turn, we can inform industry right back. And I know the companies with which you worked in our Advanced Supply Chain Collaborative have benefited immensely and continue to learn from you. Stephanie, to bring you back in, again, this really kind of fulfills this vision or prophecy, I guess, that we try to espouse around how we conduct research here at UT. As the director of the PhD program, can you speak a little bit about how we kind of train and enculturate our students into that way of thinking and practice?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it starts with the involvement in the forum. So you mentioned it earlier in the podcast, and we've got this Global Supply Chain Institute and these forums every fall and every spring. And from that first fall that our students at the program, they're expected to be a part of that forum, to attend, to meet with our partners, to oftentimes lead sessions or sit on panels. Annie, I don't know how many times you've been on the big stage already. It's probably a little bit unique how much you have had interactions on the stage. But yeah, I think that's key for getting them used to the Tennessee way.
Yeah, you talk about the Tennessee way, and I think it really is important. I go back to touchstones that we've had here at University of Tennessee, like Tom Mentzer, who wrote an article back in the early 2000s about academic research should be about rigor and relevance. I know required reading for all of our doctoral students, right, Steph? And I think that is really our touchstone, that we don't ever want to do research that appeals only to our other academic colleagues, but also has an edge to it that is appealing and impactful to the folks that we interact with in industry, so that we can actually have an impact on the way they conduct their business. Tom always used to say, Tom Mentzer, this is not just Tom Goolsbee, but he says it too, that every research article we publish, our practitioner friends should be able to read the introduction and the conclusions and come away with some way that they can change whatever particular area of practice that we're talking about. And I think we've tried to uphold that. But that's not easy to do, right? We all know that to do both good, theoretically rigorous academic research and relevant practical research is a difficult challenge. Stephanie and Annie, could you, I'm really thinking about this one essay, Annie, that you did in your dissertation that you and Stephanie were really the drivers of. How do you structure research that has a lot of interest to industry, but is rigorous enough that it's publishable in academic scientific journals?
I think we're super lucky in that we do behavioral research. There is such an interest. It's incredible how starved our industry partners have been to learn more about what we're doing, to learn more about their workers' behaviors, to learn more about these systematic biases that impact the way they do their work. You know, a lot of times we think of our research as being too far out there to be relevant, but we're dealing with people. It is in every way, shape, and form relevant. And Annie, I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's been tricky, first off, to understand, especially with my engineering background. It's easy for me to go to a problem and say, okay, well, I can fix that. But understanding really how those problems apply on a broader perspective is difficult. So the project that Ted's talking about specifically, investigated planner behaviors after a disruption. And we were able to get 200 planners to take a behavioral experiment for us, all from different companies that are within our supply chain forum. And to get that many people to participate in something like this just speaks to the relevance of the topic, because it's something where I would reach out, hey, here's what I'm doing. Are you guys interested in participating with us? The companies would hopefully respond. Most of them said yes. And at that point, we got to do this whole half a day session where we investigated different behavioral biases. We investigated how they responded to our particular situation and how that potentially could impact their results on the other side. So it was difficult to get that balance, but between talking to different companies and understanding what are their issues that they're seeing in their current supply chains and backing that out to try to make research out of it is doable. I personally think that it's very fulfilling. For me, it's really great to talk about my research projects up on, you know, the big stage at the Supply Chain Forum and have people come and talk to me afterwards and say, hey, that's really cool. Can you do something like that for my company? Or what is your next project that you're working on? Can we be a participant in it? And it just speaks to the volumes that I think Tennessee is very unique for and how we are really trying to balance that rigor and relevance for academic research.
I'll have to say, as a proud doctoral student advisor to Annie, it has given me no measure of satisfaction to see her be able to make her presentations to chief supply chain officers and their staffs at Fortune 50 companies and have them be as excited about her findings as when she presents at an academic conference. And I mean, that's kind of what we're aiming for, right? Can you all, Stephanie and Annie, can you talk a little bit about what you see as the benefits to industry of academic scholarship? And let's kick it bigger, right? Annie's a millennial. We know we have to talk about this with millennials. The benefits to society.
You know, from the business perspective, a lot of our research tells folks how things should be done. We have mathematical formulas, we have optimals that we can work to, and that's all fine and good. But for the research that I do and for the research that Annie and I have worked on together, at the end of the day, people don't behave the way that they're supposed to. And so for us to be able to track, to tap into those systematic ways that people are deviating from how we would like them to do their work helps organizations design training or to design new processes that take advantage of those biases or to ward them off in the case that we don't want to see that behavior. It's not surprising, really, that there's so much organizational interest in what we're doing, because I think the results can be taken and applied almost immediately to improve performance in the workforce.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. And I think it's also interesting because there are all these optimal things that we should be doing. And so to understand, first off, how these biases might happen, it's not just the context that we present. It's also understanding how does behavior overall impact what we're doing within business. And how does that impact society, right? So it's not just like this one very specific research question, but I think exposing this very simple research question and the findings that we have from our research, it really gives companies kind of a platform to think, okay, where else could this be applied? How else should we fix this? And what needs to happen within our systems to have the best performance and to ensure that our people get the supplies that they need at the end of the day?
Well, this has been really, really interesting to me. And I know for those of you who are practitioners out there that have an interest potentially of one day being a scholar, please let us know at our gsci@utk.edu email, and we'll reach out to you. We're always looking for great people to enter our ranks. We always consider ourselves the educators of the future leaders of the supply chain world. And without great people becoming academic scholars, we don't have those folks to do the education. So we're always looking for great people. Tom and I, when we were younger folks with either more hair or hair that wasn't gray, came up with this thing that we called the wheel of academia that said, you know, it starts with a really good question about how are things to be done? How should they be done, Stephanie, as you said? And then taking that question to industry to find out where are things being done that work really well and what are the characteristics of those things that work well? And in a lot of different areas, and Stephanie brings up the fact that it's not just systems, right? These are completed by people. So we have to have the behavioral aspects of it. And then bringing that back to the academic perspective and subjecting what we find to rigorous testing, et cetera, so that we can separate truth from hype, if you will. I think that at two different points in their careers, Stephanie and Annie are incredible exemplars of this way of conducting academic scholarship. Stephanie has been with us for a while. She's taking increasing positions of leadership, both in our scholarship as well and research, as well as in our interactions with executives. Annie is going out to join one of the top supply chain programs in the world, and that's a recognition of what she's been able to accomplish in her very young career. So we're looking forward to the two of you. Probably in 10 years, you two might be doing this podcast. So thanks for being with us, you all. We love working with you. You're not only colleagues, but you're really good friends and family, and we really appreciate you stopping by. Tom, you want to bring us home?
No, I was going to say, I think that's a great place to put a wrap on this episode of the podcast, and we're really pleased to bring it to you here from Rocky Top and look forward to more. As Ted indicated, if you got any interest in participating in what we do, whether it's maybe submitting an application to our PhD program, or maybe offering adjunct instruction, or just simply offering us some critique and input to this podcast, you can reach us at gsci@utk.edu. And with that, we'll call it a wrap. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to Tennessee on Supply Chain Management. If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe via your favorite listening platform, such as iTunes or Spotify. And if you have questions, we'd love to hear from our listeners. Leave a reply in our show notes at gscipodcast.com or email your questions to gsci@utk.edu. Join us next time in our pursuit to prove that supply chain management is more fun than you think.